Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here is your host, Sean Graham.
And thank you, Adam. Welcome to History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham. We're coming at you today nearly live from Ottawa, Ontario. We're at the National Arts Centre in the Hexagon Studio, kicking off our Northern History Week. And we're here today to talk about a couple of the films that are coming as part of Northern Scene here at the National Arts Centre. And joining us, very exciting, Tom McSorley, Executive Director of the Canadian Film Institute, also a sessional lecturer at Carleton in Film Studies, and a film and theater critic for CBC Radio 1. Tom, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Great to have you here. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about two different films that are coming in. First, Nanook of the North, mm-hmm. and then The Grubstake. And I guess we'll take them chronologically.
Sure.
And we'll do Nanook first.
Right.
Because it was released in 1922.
Yeah.
So basically, what is Nanook of the North? What's the movie about?
Well, it's a kind of a, for its time, this is a, I started to imagine like 9 decades ago when this film was released. It was a groundbreaking vision of the North. I mean, the North exists in so many ways in the imagination, and particularly for Europeans, Germany in particular, they have a fascination with things that are Nordic,
right.
and Nordic peoples generally. But yeah, this film was a kind of window into a, literally an unseen world. And this is, again, it's hard to imagine in our day, you know, of YouTube uploads and stuff. Like this was like pre-television and you know, this is an image, a moving image of what they were called Eskimo life. I mean, an Inuit community in the north of Ungava Bay. So it was literally an eye-opening and figuratively an eye-opening experience for audiences to be transported the way cinema can do to these, you know, very remote, almost unknown places, just geographically speaking.
Right.
And then to have exposure to a cultural set of cultural practices that the Inuit perform, hunting and cooking and all that stuff, was quite, it was received with as a sensation. Mm-hmm. And it's funny when you look at it now, it seems there's a lot of problems that we have with it in terms of appropriation and the cultural politics of the film. But in 1922, 23, when it was making the rounds, it was literally seen as a revelation of, of a place hitherto unknown. So very, very exciting time for the filmmaker Robert Flaherty, who was a documentary filmmaker. And it really kind of made his career as a kind of chronicler of contemporary times. And his you know, window into the Inuit world was, as I say, a kind of a sensation in cinematic circles.
No, Robert Flaherty himself, an interesting guy because he wasn't just a filmmaker, and obviously because you know he had to work before there was film, so he couldn't just be a filmmaker. So his background was in the North on other work related items, and he started to do this film in the late teens.
That's right. Yeah,
and he came back, and then it's destroyed.
He lost. It was nitrates footage, which is very unstable. Before safety stock came along, they were making these films on nitrate stock, which is chemically very unstable, and he lost 30,000 feet of footage or something like that. So he had to, you know, this is 1916 or 17, and he decided, well, you know, as a kind of amateur ethnographer in a way, he decided he had to go back because, you know, this was too good not to use and not to have a record of this place. So, yeah, he was very familiar with the North, and to his credit, he was actually, you know, engaged in research and all kinds of other things up there. So he wasn't just some dilettante from New York City or something going up north because it's cool and exotic. He was actually very much interested in the culture and the landscape, and he wanted to render that, obviously, so badly that he went back to shoot some more.
In the title sequence, there's the text.
Yes.
And it says, I went back this time just to shoot the movie.
That's right.
Every other time I went up, I was doing other things.
Yeah.
This
time,
it's just
to
shoot.
The movie, yeah.
And it's a year-long shoot.
That's right.
And he comes back with all this footage, and he puts it together.
That's right, yeah.
Now, is this the first documentary in the history of film? Or is it maybe just the most notable early example of
it's the most notable, and of course, it's a feature-length documentary, which is almost unheard of. There were plenty of travel logs and kind of newsreel. In fact, some of the first films in Canada, made in Canada, were travelogues, some of which were they're mostly Western Canada, produced by the CPR, the railway to encourage immigration, actually, for Europeans to come to Canada. But it was not that, didn't go that far north. Some of it as far north as Jasper, I think. But in Flaherty's case, the fact that he created a movie, quote-unquote, like a feature-length film out of this, was kind of unseen or unheard of at the time. So it was, again, at that level, just, and you have to remember that this is something we'll talk about when we talk about the grubstake, too. This is an industry, a film industry, in kind of a nascent state. It has concretized itself into an industry in the teens, okay. Starting to be, you know, commercialized and industrialized in Hollywood, primarily.
Yeah.
But what is a film? Well, a film is 90 minutes or 100 minutes in length. Because why? Well, because we want to show it twice on the same night. Why? Well, so we can double our profits.
Yeah.
So this idea of how films are, the length of them, it's really interesting because it does come out of the first part of the 20th century and the industrialization of movies. So that Robert Flaherty then is getting access to exposure in an industry in a commercial sense because his film is the right length. It's right. Not a 10-minute travelogue. It's not mm-hmm. a short. It's a feature. Mm-hmm. So that was, in a way, kind of really smart of him. Clearly he's passionate about what he was mm-hmm. filming and he wanted to record as much of it as he could. But the idea that he put it together as a feature-length documentary at that time was pretty much a pioneering gesture on his part.
And it was sort of a springboard for his career, right? Mm-hmm. Like he gets this title of the pioneer of the documentary.
Yes, absolutely.
And he moves forward. So is that one of the biggest legacies of the movie, is the launching of maybe the genre,
yeah.
but also this filmmaker?
I think so. And all of the the subsequent philosophical debates about documentary cinema, or nonfiction cinema, as yeah. it's called, is engendered really by this movie, too. So he made a number of other very important documentaries in the UK, Man of Arran, for example, off the coast of Ireland, and others. But yeah, this film became, I think, in a way, because of its subject matter, because it was so unusual a subject,
right.
And so, in a way, enchanting for, again, the Southern imagination, thinking about, the North, what's the North? Snow and igloos. And even the title cards in the film are, evoke a kind of romanticism yeah. about this very, very difficult life that the Inuit lead, but have led for millennia. So yeah, his arrival with Nanook in the world of documentary, one, made it seem like, well, you can make a film, a quote unquote, a movie that's nonfiction, and people will go and see it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an important realization. And secondly, documentary's role as a kind of expository cinema that tells us things about the world we live in, also wasn't unheard of before Flaherty, but he certainly made it into something a much more ambitious form.
Now, part of that ambition, though, is trying to make things look perhaps better than they
right.
were.
The camera, you're a slave to the camera. Yeah. Right, right.
So there's scenes in which they're staged.
Mm-hmm.
Nanook himself, obviously that's not his name.
Yeah, it's not his name, right. Yeah.
And the person who is playing his wife isn't actually his
right.
wife. Some of the more powerful scenes
mm-hmm.
are staged.
Yes.
With the couple of the hunting scenes.
Yep.
And this,
because they were hunting with guns at that point,
right.
and he got them to hunt with harpoons in terms of the one scene with the walrus.
Yeah.
But they were already, technologically, they'd moved on to the gun. They weren't
mm-hmm.
they weren't doing these traditional things that he wanted them to do.
But because that's something as a viewer, and maybe it's me looking at it when mm-hmm. I watched it in 2013 that
yeah.
I wouldn't have picked up in 1922, but
yeah.
one of the first scenes in the movie is he's at a trading post.
That's right.
With a European trader, mm-hmm. and he's showing him the gramophone, which is another stage scene.
Yeah,
he knew how a gramophone worked.
Yeah.
And he bites the record.
Yeah,
it's interesting to see this. The at least perception of first contact with new technology.
Yes, that's right, right.
But logically, if he's dealing with this trader, he would have been, or would have had access to guns.
Of course, yeah.
So there's a logical
yeah,
flaw in having
right.
that scene first that it just
yeah.
doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I think a lot of it, again, it goes back to this, the thing about it, what's so interesting to me about memory in terms of how we experience media, for our times, we can go back and watch something a million times. We can watch it, TV shows, when we recorded them on VHS, we'd watch them over.
Right.
And so you can pick up on these kinds of illogical things. Mm-hmm. But when you see it once, and you're seeing it in real time, let's say you go to see Nanook of the North in 1922
right.
in some theater, you're not going to, you might reflect on that later, but you
right.
won't go back and actually look at the film again the way we've done.
Right, yeah.
So that's one thing. I'm sure he would have thought, well, no one's going to notice.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think what you said earlier was interesting, is that the staging of these events, in a way, for perhaps this is Flaherty's teleological approach. Like, I have to show these people in the way that I've always imagined them to be.
Right.
Because my audiences will have a certain level of conceptualization of how Inuit Eskimos live. Right. So I'll do it this way. And you're right, that first contact thing, like biting the vinyl record, you know, it's in a way ridiculous, and insulting, mm-hmm. To Inuit, the sophistication of that culture. On the other hand, he's playing that kind of game. And mm-hmm. what's interesting about staging in documentary, that's a really interesting issue and still is debated, actually, in documentary cinema. Well, what is a documentary? Like, anytime there's a camera like this one in the room, people will behave differently. Sure. And so the whole myth of the fly on the wall, cinema verite, documentary, which became a kind of prevailing philosophy in the 50s onward, that you could actually you're not imposing on a situation by being there with your camera and your sound equipment. Well, of course you are. and Alan King, the great Canadian documentarian, always argued that documentary is not, it's a misnomer. What he liked to call his films was actuality drama. So he would go in, I don't know if you know Alan King's great films, Warrendale and A Married Couple, and he would go into situations with his crew and camera, and they would film for days, and they'd gather material the way Flaherty would have done. Yeah. And he just observed A Married Couple, for example, a famous film about this very unhappy couple in Toronto in 1969. If you ever want to watch a film about a bad marriage, this is the one. So he installs himself in the house with his crew, and they stay for a week or two, and they don't do anything except shoot, and then they edit it later. Mm-hmm. But clearly the people are responding to the fact that there is the presence of the camera. Mm-hmm. And so they might not be faking things, but their behavior is changed somewhat by the presence of the camera. So this goes back again to Flaherty, where he's saying, well, you know, I should set up a scene my audiences can actually see them hunting a walrus the way they used to do, even though they don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And maybe he thought, well, he could rationalize it by saying, well, you know, what this film is trying to do is preserve some cultural traditions that he thinks are disappearing. This is always the paradox of that kind of, that kind of filmmaking, that you're shooting stuff that's disappearing. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting thing. And he took a lot of heat for that, just in terms of the, you know, well, that's not documentary if you do that. But the debate went on and on until it came around to this, you know, it's much more sophisticated debate now about, because as you know, if you've watched Michael Moore or other documentary filmmakers, there's constant kinds of reenactments going on. Mm-hmm. And so there's this it's a more promiscuous form than simply it must be the recorded truth. Yeah. And that's always been the myth of documentary, is that somehow it's telling the truth more than fiction.
Right,
but which is never really true.
But one of the things I wonder, though, is that, I mean, and you hear this from people who, like the producers of shows like The Real World and stuff like this, and they say, well, the cameras are always there, so while people may be conscious of them and alter their behavior for a week or two, once we're there for a month or 2 months, it's part of everyday life, and they'll revert back to the normal way. And since Flaherty is there for a year, I wonder if he used a similar argument.
I mean, that whole idea that there is somebody watching you. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can ever get completely oblivious to the presence of a camera. Maybe some people can. Maybe they're so narcissistic they don't even they actually love that the camera's there.
Right.
In the reality TV world, which is neither TV nor reality in my view. But in the case of Nanook, and remember in those days the equipment itself was massive and it was heavy and it was very difficult to ignore it, you know? And then when they would have to do things when they couldn't get a shot inside the finished igloo because it's too dark.
Yeah.
So they made
another
igloo with an open wall. And that way the camera can be put in and you can shoot the ceiling of it. And it's totally fake. On the other hand, well, it's serving a larger truth, I suppose. So again, this film is fascinating for all of those reasons still.
Yeah.
The first vision of this place and what he's doing and how he's depicting the traditional quote-unquote customs of the Inuit, it's all still relevant in a weird sort of way, even though we can kind of look at it and from a distance and say, well, it's quite manipulative and perhaps naive and maybe even a little bit, you know, unseemly what he's doing.
Yeah. Well, I think my favorite part of the igloo stuff is that when they're standing outside of the igloo, they're, you know, six inches taller than the igloo.
Right.
And then the scenes inside the igloo, they can stand up fine.
That's
right. You got lots of room.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait a minute.
It's true. Yeah.
It's great.
It's the, what's the old, you know, the old phrase about fiction is the lie that tells the truth.
That's right.
In some ways, Flaherty is doing that. And but I think that the, you know, the trading posts, as you say, I mean, it's illogical to think that, that they would not have, I mean, they are actively, consciously trading with, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not like there's some, so that plays into that other question that you had raised before about cultural appropriation, where, you know, the gaze of the filmmaker is a superior one or imagines itself to be above its subject. And that's a very legitimate concern and has been with this film, obviously. Yeah. It's a, such a legendary film in many ways. Mm. About the attitude of the filmmaker to the subject.
Right.
But I don't, you know, I'm of two minds of it. Partially it's like the, it's the 1920s and in the teens, but, you know, and that's, that kind of condescension, you know, is, there's a whole sad litany of historical interventions.
He's not the first person to exploit
Aboriginal
people in this country.
Exactly. Yeah. Yet, he was also not a dilettante. He was, he was there, he was, he worked around those people. He was up there for years.
Yeah.
So that kind of, in a way, you know, redeems some of the skepticism about him. If he had simply parachuted in and created a kind of cartoon of, you know, of, quote, Eskimo life, unquote, then it would be a little bit more reprehensible.
I think it's kind of a cartoon, though.
Yep, I think it is. Elements of it is, are very kind of like, ooh, geez, you went with that.
Like, really? Okay.
Yeah, that's the 20s, I guess.
I mean, you got to put it into the proper context.
But absolutely, it deserves that kind of analysis and criticism for its position, because it is, again, never get in the head of Robert Flaherty, but what was he thinking about in terms of the marketability of this film?
Right.
In terms of, like, this will make audiences, it will reaffirm audiences' predispositions toward what the North is like in the first place, and what Eskimos are like.
Yeah.
So I'll give them that, what they want, and then they'll leave the theater without any doubt about their own thinking.
Right.
Which, you know, to my mind, is not the job of the documentary filmmaker to affirm people's prejudices.
Right.
But that the film has that effect in a way. And yet, you know, again, there's always an and yet with this film. There is a view into that place that, you know, there's a lot of dignity in the film also. Mm. But yeah, it's too bad that it's really limited by its perspective, I think, in those days.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that sort of mitigates that is that I think he's trying to celebrate
people
in this way of
you.
Life, right?
Yeah,
so it's not it's not just I'm coming in to capture it.
Right.
I want to celebrate it and show people that there's, you know,
absolutely,
there's beauty in this, and there's a majesty to this part of the world, and that these people are happy and successful, and
totally agree.
They're living their lives, and they're just interesting people. They're not caricatures, is what we may think.
Nope.
Yes, they may engage, or I may make them engage in things that we already think they engage in,
right?
Regardless of whether or not it's true.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're savages, as other people would have called them savages at the time.
No,
right?
For
I think
sure.
He's really trying to.
Yep.
He's trying to give these people agency, that they're not faceless, this faceless culture. That they're individuals who have strong personalities. And the fact that the family is always there, I think that's an important thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
Showing this family life, that we're not that different here in the South as they are in the North.
And what's really struck me, again, having watched it just recently, is the inescapable reality of the struggle of their lives. Whether it's fishing, whether, you know, and there's always this constant theme throughout the film of hunger and the encroachment of hunger and survival that it's unrelenting. And through the whole film, there's never a sense that, you know, there are moments where they're happy, they're in the igloo, and it's there's great joy and love going on in this community.
Yeah.
But there's always that sense of imminent disaster, which I found really insistent when the last time I watched it was like, he really did capture the struggle to live in this environment. And for millennia, these people have done that.
Mm-hmm.
But it is incredible to see, you know, oh, we're out of food. We better save that seal so we can have some food. And then they get the walrus and they're so hungry when they start carving it up, they have to eat.
It's still wet.
It's incredible.
Like it hasn't even dried out of the water.
Exactly. So that's, if nothing else, Nanook of the North deromanticizes in that sense the, you know, the great landscape, and the, of course it's all in some sequences it's stunningly beautiful.
Yep.
The long shots of the dog sled and that infinite landscape. Incredibly beautiful stuff. Mm-hmm. And yet always suffused with the knowledge that this is a very harsh place to survive in. And these people are doing what they do to survive in that kind of harsh environment. So mm-hmm. very, very compelling and exactly in this sort of inherently dramatic sense.
Yeah.
That, well, what is the greatest, drama? Well, surviving.
Yeah, yeah,
it's the greatest drama.
Yeah.
So that would have resonated, I think, with people, too, in a way, mm-hmm. in the 20s and moving into, the whole notion of, the depression coming and that was later. But the idea of survival, mm-hmm. Physical survival. Yeah.
Well, especially coming out of the war, people are still dealing with the trauma of the war and the mm-hmm. death associated with that. And here's the struggle to survive.
Absolutely. And I think that that's one of the reasons... the European imagination in particular, and of course North American, is that what is it about the North? Glenn Gould did this famous series, The Idea of North. Mm-hmm. This notion, yes, we're Nordic people, but the idea, at least in the Germanic tradition of the North, is solitude and this kind mm-hmm. of romanticized landscape where you can find solitude from the riot of human affairs. Yes. So that the North occupies that peculiar romantic position in the imagination of Europeans, and especially maybe after World War I, where the carnage of that, and it seems even more romantic to get away from the civilized world. So it's interesting. It feeds into all of these larger ideas that we, some of us still do, carry around about winter, about the north, about some place to escape to.
Well, what is the exact opposite of a trench warfare?
Exactly.
I don't think you can come with a better place.
That's true.
Than the Canadian
There's no
north.
One for miles and miles around.
That's right,
yeah.
So what is going on with Northern Scene is the film is going to be played, and Tanya Tagak, with some other artists, are going to be singing the soundtrack to the film. Now, don't want to talk necessarily about the production itself, but basically it's sort of repositioning the film in a contemporary way and almost sort of giving it back to the Inuit people themselves, as opposed to through this lens of a European audience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you think that this is a valuable exercise to reposition the film in this way, or will it maybe change the message of the film and some of the power of those scenes that we've already talked about by putting this modern spin on it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm interested to find out.
Yeah.
I can only imagine that, the soundtrack for the film, that exists is a kind of romanticized sound. It's kind of romantic music. I'm really curious to see if there are going to be some dissonances that come out from her performance. So she's extraordinary and avant-garde in that sense, so that the sonic and the visual will collide. I suspect, I'm really interested to see how she's going to take the images we've talked about that are kind of cliched and condescending, and what she'll do to those those images with her sound, or with the sound of this music. So to me, I'm really eager to hear it.
Yeah.
Because, that relationship between image and sound in cinema is so important. Mm. And so it might actually be able to kind of dislodge that romanticized, those elements of the film that are romanticized.
Yeah. Especially because it's live, too.
Yeah.
Might add to that. Because the score that goes with it right now, like you say, it's very romanticized. Mm-hmm. And it's, not to be too critical, but it's the sort of thing that if you watch movies, you can sort of see where, you can almost put it there yourself.
Absolutely.
It doesn't really challenge anything.
No, and it does emphasize the emotional content of the film. In as you say, not in a very challenging way, but more in a kind of reassuring way.
Yeah.
So if you have a musician of this caliber, an Inuit musician, having a look at this thing in a different way, and then translating that perception into sound, I'm really, really interested to hear what will happen.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be a much more challenging soundtrack than the
Absolutely.
Original. So.
Yeah. No, it's a great idea. I mean, as you know, there are contemporary Inuit filmmakers like Zacharias Canuck, who made Atanarjuat back in 2001, and several other films since, that are, they're making their own stories and telling their own stories in their own way.
Right.
But to take Flaherty's thing and then throw it into the blender, I think that's going to be really cool.
Yeah. Because, you have the two different cultures meeting, and then you also have the time element.
Absolutely.
Of that it's 90 years.
Yes, exactly.
Since this movie was made.
That's right.
And sort of taking that spin as well. I think it will be really interesting to see.
I can't imagine it would be anything but a confrontation.
Yeah.
At some level with the images through sound. So not in all cases, but I think there will, because as we've discussed, there's some very dignified moments in the film as well. So it would be really cool to hear that interpretation from
it'll take what's already a very powerful piece and make it even more powerful. Because when I watched it the first time, there's parts of the 80 minutes or 90 minutes, whatever it is, where you can sort of relax and you're okay, you're not really into it. But this one, I think it'll be intense the whole way through.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine it will be. And, you know, she's worked with Bjork, and she's done all kinds of very, very interesting throat singing and all that stuff. I can just kind of hear it almost, you know. Just be really curious to see where it goes, though, in these various aspects of the film that that drift into appropriation or that, you know, that are more dignified, like the record chewing scene. Like, can't wait to hear what happens.
That'll be interesting.
You know?
Yeah. That one and I think that one and the igloo, I think, are the two scenes that I'm most interested to see how they play them.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, the other film that we want to talk about is Grubstake.
Yeah.
1923 film starring Nell Shipman.
Nell Shipman, yeah.
Now, before we get into Nell Shipman, what's the premise of this movie?
Well, the premise of the Grubstake, is a very small claim that you make in the North, like a stake. So grub meaning, you know. So it's a melodrama, and it revolves around a woman named Faith Diggs who lives down on the Atlantic coast, and she is courted by this kind of strange, sinister manipulator guy named Leroy, who's a gambler. Mm-hmm. And she and her father, who's a retired mariner, they're kind of struggling to get along. And he says, well, look, marry me. We'll go up north, and I'll set you up with a stake. So they do. And it turns out that Leroy's a pimp. And he wants her to work in the sex trade in the Klondike, because a lot of traffic of people coming in there trying to make millions and stuff.
Yeah.
So she soon kind of figures out the lay of the land and goes, oh, okay, this is what this guy's about. It's not about love and romance. He's putting me into prostitution. So the film then becomes, how does she escape from this servitude?
Yeah.
So I don't want to say it anymore so people can see it. But it is a classic silent era melodrama. Mm-hmm. And its location, it was filmed in Washington State. It wasn't filmed in the Yukon, but it's set in Canada's north. Is interesting because Nell Shipman's career, her early films, one in particular called Back to God's Country in 1919, was also set was shot in northern Alberta. But it deals with a woman, again, trying to escape from this character who's after her. And in all of her movies, Nell Shipman is a very strong protagonist, which is kind of unusual for women characters in the silent era.
For sure.
So it's a funny kind of... She has a great connection with nature. There's a kind of pantheist sensibility in Nell Shipman's films where she's, for example, there's a bear in Grubstake, which she hibernates with the bear. There's a lot of stuff that goes on stretches credulity. but nevertheless, it is one of those northern melodramas that, again, trucks in this kind of currency of the North as a romantic but dangerous place.
Right.
But also a place of great freedom because you are connected to the landscape and the character of Faith, Nell's character. She's connected to the natural world in the way that the men aren't. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of overlap with, I suppose, with the Inuit experience and that connection with the earth, the planet or nature that Southerners don't have or that they've become alienated from. So it's a completely different experience as a film. I mean, it's often quite funny, it's ludicrous, it's over the top in terms of melodramatic effect.
Vaudevillian in that way?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. But that was, again, we're talking about, which is interesting again about both, they're almost from the same year. This is the beginning of the movies as an industry.
Right.
And Nell Shipman was, perhaps like Flaherty or in a different way, trying to make popular entertainments. She's not Ingmar Bergman, she's not making art movies. She's making basically like a TV show. She's trying to make something that is generic. People are familiar with these stories, but she's also wanting to set it in an exotic landscape, and then bring in animals. Like they literally, there's a bear, a trained bear that and there's raccoons and there's, you name it. It's very sweet in that way, and quite a kind of sacred in another sense. But it's about how, in her work anyway, you take, you know, a popular art form, the endangered heroine in a melodramatic situation, how she escapes from this. Mm-hmm. But you're relocated in a weird sort of way into a natural versus civilizational drama, and that's what she does in Grubstake.
Now, you mentioned that it's not shot in the North, even though it's set in the Klondike. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I realize that this is commonplace in the film industry.
Absolutely.
You know, cities
get... It's the movies, man.
That's right.
Yeah.
Nothing's real.
Nothing's real, exactly.
But in this case, because the North is so distinct, mm-hmm. and, you know, just talking about Nanook, is this...
Yeah.
People want to... There's this fascination with what the North is.
That's right.
The fact that it's shot in Washington State changed the meaning of the film and this connection to nature that Shipman makes?
Only retroactively, or only retrospectively. Okay. Like, it's like, you know, if you knew that Twin Peaks was shot in Vancouver,
right.
You know, it was supposed to be San Francisco.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Or the Hurt Locker that's supposed to be shot in Iraq.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, the debates about image and reality are infinite, potentially. Right. But in this case, for Nell Shipman, it was basically her life. She had moved from... she was born in Victoria, grew up in Victoria, but her family, basically she grew up in Washington State in Seattle. But she became involved with a film producer, actually a guy from Hull, Ernie Shipman, which is how she got her last name.
Yeah.
He was a very, very swashbuckling kind of producer type in Canada in the 20s and the teens, who went around to various cities, Calgary, for example, and pitched ideas at the local, you know, merchant class and said, invest in this movie of mine, we're going to shoot it up in northern Alberta. And, you know, it'll be made here and you guys will get profit. And so Back to God's Country, which is a film from 1919 that kind of made Nell Shipman into a star in those days. So very much was successful because of that sort of romance of the North stuff.
Right.
So even when she went back into the States and she and Ernie split, and she was a filmmaker. She was a film producer who saw the market appetite based on her previous success of this kind of setting. So let's make it. Let's make the Grubstake and let's set it up in the, you know, the romantic North far away. And they brought in wind machines and snow machines in Washington State. They didn't even shoot it in, you know, in blizzard conditions. They made the blizzard conditions.
Right.
But the idea was so compelling at the level of the imagination and for her that this doesn't matter where we shoot it. We just have to make it sure that it's set up there because people have an idea about the North.
Right.
And I have an idea about, you know, the power and agency of women and their connection to nature and the characters that I play. So all of that is very like pot boiler stuff, you know. But for her, that was her template. It was like, this is like the stories of Jack London or, you know, that kind of literature about the North. Very much played into her filmmaking, as it were, and her stardom as well.
Yeah. Now, this film though wasn't particularly successful at the
time. It was not successful.
So you talked about bringing in like the animals and snow machines. One of the reviews I saw said the budget was $180,000.
Yeah, it was enormous for that time.
That's ridiculously huge
for
1920. If they're probably making it in 22 then.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in 23, for it to be released in 23.
That's right.
So this movie doesn't really have the greatest legacy.
No, in fact.
For a variety of reasons.
That's right.
First, it bankrupted Shipman's company.
It did. Mm-hmm.
And two, it was never released widely, right?
No.
Now, why?
Well, that's, again, the industry has so many stories like this. So if we can take out quality for a moment as a condition.
Well, that usually doesn't matter in the film industry if something's
successful. Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. So the reality of it was, in terms, again, this fledgling commercialization of the film industry in the teens and 20s, distribution patterns were completely controlled by the major studios, who basically had no interest in independent producers making films. She was one of those. She's an indie. Like, she's like any indie today.
Yeah.
She's not affiliated with a studio.
Right.
And so they're not interested in the product produced outside of their own factory because they own the delivery system of their product. So marginalized that way in terms of just the industry itself, regardless of the quality of the film.
Yeah.
But she made a few sales. Made one sale of Grubstake in New York. She would go to New York, really an amazing story. She would go to New York on the train or whatever and bring her film with her, and they'd set up screenings in New York for independent distributors.
Oh, wow.
So like a marketplace, really.
Yeah.
And she took the first offer she got. She didn't think it was going to be... She, in a way, was also conscious of the fact that maybe Back to God's Country was the, you know, the high watermark, and this kind of genre is not going to, you know, persist, because she got a sense from the screenings at the, for the buyers, that they weren't really getting into it. Anyway, she made a sale, and it was a very pitiful amount. She got a call from another guy who offered her like double the amount of that. She'd already made the sale. So partially it's the biz, and you can divorce that from the content, because in many senses it has nothing to do with the content. It's how that content is perceived to be marketable. So in the case of, this film was very large budgeted. Investors didn't get anything back in their for their investment. But again, the film is so exotic, and they created the exoticism rather than shooting in northern Alberta in the snowy wastelands like they did with Back to Guns Country, that they had to recreate it, which accounted for a lot of the budget. And then it just didn't, it got no legs under it. And, you know, you look at it now, and it is kind of a trite film in many ways, but it's also a film that, you know, at least is attempting, and it's interesting in her career that she's very much trying to get this kind of pantheist vision across. And it's not trivial. It's kind of this really interesting approach she's taken to, one, the female protagonist as being the agent of power and change, and two, connecting that female protagonist with nature. Like very overtly, almost like ridiculously in many ways. You know, she literally, and the whole idea of the story, I mean, there's a certain sequence where she gets lost in this blizzard and she ends up in hibernating with a bear. Like, it just goes, like for 3 or 4 months, I guess, she has a snooze in her blouse and dress and then comes out and it's spring. So, you know, all of these like preposterous things that happen in, well, it's the movies, man. But anyway, so she's, but nevertheless connecting or trying to make, you know, that the undoing of the evil guy will come as a result of this conspiracy of nature and nurture, this woman and her new love and another woman in the film who she befriends, who's her boss under this pimp. They become allies because they know, you know, this isn't right. And so it's funny how she just kind of like tells that story again and again. And but yeah, outside the frame, shall we say, that wasn't working for in commercial terms.
Now, because of that commercial failure, then, what's the film's legacy? I mean, why are we still? Why do we even know about it?
Like, well, really, we don't really. Like, I mean, it's a rarity. It's one of the early. Nell Shipman is really quite an exception. There was almost no film production in Canada, and this, of course, this film wasn't made in Canada, but. Absolutely none. Maybe there are 3 or 4 features made in the first 20 years of the 20th century. What small population, not a lot of money, you know, all the reasons that are obvious. This film, though, is interesting historically. I don't think it's particularly interesting aesthetically. And it's kind of been saved. You know, it's a film that survived. I mean, a couple of her other films, interim films in between, The Girl from God's Country and others, they're completely lost. They're gone. Again, these were commodities produced. They weren't without a view toward preservation. The accidents of these things existing in the archives, because this one's coming from the archives, this print, you know, it's really kind of ad hoc, hit or miss. So it isn't, you know, a great discovery in terms of, you know, cinematic masterpiece that nobody's seen before. It's not that, but what it is, it allows you to piece together a particular period of film production in Canada. And as we've been talking about, this whole idea that in Nell Shipman's case, because she was kind of like, you know, a pioneer in many ways in terms of her involvement in the productions themselves, not only on screen but as producer and as screenwriter, that this was a period of great kind of fluidity in the film industry. But here's a woman who's very interested in the North and is kind of bought into a literature that was popular in magazines. And James Oliver Curwood, who was a writer who wrote adventure stories in the North, Jack London, all of that idea really struck her imagination. And she thought that this would be a marketable thing. Right. And maybe, like Flaherty, she thought, hey, this documentary, people will want to see this because nobody sees this part of the world. In the pre-television world, right? So it's funny the two films are juxtaposed in Northern Scene for that reason. But you know, I just think it's kind of a diversion, a kind of delight to watch The Grubstake, because it's really oafish in many ways in its direction and quite like over the top in terms of melodrama. Uh-huh. But that's part of the pleasure of these artifacts, if you want to call them, right. of that era, that you can see through all of the nonsense. Mm-hmm. But as I said with Nell Shipman, what I always find fascinating about her is this sort of alignment of the female with nature, which is not unheard of in Western civilization, obviously. But in her insistence on setting this stuff in remote areas and human societies trying to figure themselves out in very harsh environments, and how is it that women can prevail over that kind of cynical opportunism of men? So that's really her legacy in that sense.
So this movie is more, whereas Nanook is really more sort of maybe reframing that movie. Mm-hmm. This the Grubstake for Northern Scene is more rediscovering. The film.
That's right.
And Nell Shipman as an actress, as a producer, and just a general artist, and a major player in early Canadian film.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So the Grubstake, what they're doing for the Grubstake here is it's really kind of cool. There's going to be live actors.
Yes, that's right.
Who will be doing the
dialogue.
The dialogue, which is subtitled.
Yeah,
in the
intertitled.
Film.
Yeah,
intertitled. Yeah. In the film. But it's going to be in a Shakespearean style.
That's right.
And there's also going to be live musicians.
That's right.
Who have changed the score.
Yes.
And so that'll be going on live while the film is playing.
Exactly. And that is a lot of fun. I mean, the DVD.
This has gotten great reviews.
Yeah, yeah.
It's played across the country in a few spots. It's got great reviews.
It is a reanimation of what is, largely an inferior film. but the experience of it is very, very exciting because that, one, it's a very rare thing to have that happen. I mean, usually it's just musical accompaniment. But to have, like, actors doing, kind of elevated English language poetic dialogue to what is really kind of the most conventional sort of potboiler is very funny. In the kind of clang between the language and the images.
Yeah.
And it's on the DVD that I brought. It's fun. This is the thing about it. It's fun. And this film wasn't made to make some grand statement about, the human existential crises.
No.
It's entertainment. And Nell Shipman herself knew when she was making it, this is the reason for making this, is I like to tell these potboiler stories. So having a kind of animated through live actors and live musicians, I think is fantastic as an idea. And I know that it was generated in the Yukon. This project came out of Whitehorse. So it's great. I mean, and it really lends the film more than it deserves in many ways. So you wouldn't go see the Grubstake for itself, let's put it that way.
Okay.
You might if you're interested in the silent movies and in Nell Shipman in particular. Right. But it really is kind of fun to watch this kind of like hokey story be given a kind of reading by these actors, and the language is funny. Yeah. And it lends a kind of energy to the film, which, again, don't get me wrong, the film is not bad or unwatchable. It's not at all. It's actually quite amazing, especially the sequences with the bear. But, to have this reanimated, I think, is a great idea.
Now, both of these things, both the Nanook and Grubstake, are going to be playing at the Mayfair Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've never been in the Mayfair Theater.
Oh, wow, you do yourself a favor.
So I'm gonna go to both of these.
Yeah.
My question, though, is just in terms of the theater itself.
Right.
And how does that particular theater, out of the thousands of theaters that you could play this thing in.
Yeah.
I'm sure there was a reason why the Mayfair was chosen.
Sure. Yeah.
And obviously you've been in there a bunch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For watching films. Now, how do you think the Mayfair Theater, for people who are going to go see it when it's in Ottawa, how will that contribute, do you think, to the overall experience of these films?
I think it'll contribute a lot. It's a grand old cinema. Uh-huh. Like a theater
from the
20s or 30s. Yeah. So it has the architecture, it has the vibe, it has the whole, even the configuration of the seats. There's a balcony, and this beautiful lobby that's kind of small, but it's like beautiful terrazzo floor and stuff. So there's already an atmosphere about it that speaks to an earlier era in filmmaking and film experience, actually, not just filmmaking, but consumption of images by people who would go to the movies, pre-television era.
Right.
So I think it's really appropriate. I'm not sure where the actors will and the performers will be. I know there's an area in the front of the screen that seats are removable, so they'll probably put them in there. But But I think it's a great space. Yeah. I mean, you could put it, of course, you could put it in the NAC, in the theater, yeah. which has a bit more of an august sort of feel to it. Mm-hmm. These films are a little more gritty, I mean, in that way. I think it suits them, right. the tone of them to be in that space, right. rather than in a more formalized presentation space. Right. So, you know, for the performance of Tanya Tagak with Nanook, that will be really interesting too, just acoustically because of the place.
Right.
It has a very, very nice kind of grubby, shabby atmosphere, which I think these films in their day would have been shown in theaters not unlike the Mayfair.
So, right, yeah, that would be a nice connection to see it in a, obviously it would have been renovated since it was built.
Sure.
But I mean the style of it in a 1920s style theater.
Absolutely.
To watch 1920s films.
Yeah. No, it's a great idea.
Had a nice ambiance to it.
Absolutely.
So the two films, we got Nanook of the North and The Grubstak Revisited. Grubstak Revisited is the first one. Mm-hmm. It's Friday, May the 3rd at 8 p.m. at the Mayfair Theater, which is on Bank Street,
right?
Just south of Lansdowne.
That's right.
Park, just over the bridge.
Over the bridge, yep.
And Tanya Tagak, Nanook of the North, Saturday, May 4th, also at 8 p.m., again at the Mayfair Theater. If you're in the National Capital Region, strongly recommend
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
To go see them. You can find ticket information, all that, at the National Arts Center website through the Northern Scene. And I'm sure maybe even the box office here would probably sell them, probably the box office at the Mayfair. If you call up them, they
Absolutely.
Would have information as well.
And it's I think it's a 350-seat theater, so get your tickets early.
Yeah.
Hopefully they'll be full, because it'll be both nights will be remarkable, I think.
And if it's full, that'll add even more to it.
Yeah, for sure.
It's always more fun to see movies with a large crowd than when you're the only person in the theater.
Totally.
Which isn't that much fun,
I gotta say. It's not, no.
So, Tom McSorley, Executive Director of the Canadian Film Institute. Thanks a lot for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. So, that is Tom McSorley again, Executive Director, Canadian Film Institute, Sessional Lecturer at Carleton University, and you can also find his work on CBC Radio 1. I would like to thank Martin here in the Hexagon Studio, Marnie Richardson, also Carla Wolf, Laura Danker for helping setting all this up. As part of Northern History Week, we will be back tomorrow with another Northern History podcast. And another piece at activehistory.ca. And as always, if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Check out activehistory.ca for more features and articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.